Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.
For a long time, I've wondered why some companies succeed and some don't. Why one can rise to be synonymous with an industry while many of the most creative on the planet toil away in relative obscurity. I'm Jeff Eccles, and I invite you to join me for the Build Your Brand podcast. From Gable Media, creators of the Entree Architect podcast, this is the podcast miniseries where I explore how the best brands in the world think differently and act differently on their way to becoming the best, and what you can learn from them, because no matter the size, the journey is the same. This season, I'll open the cowl and look inside Southwest Airlines to see what makes them tick and what architects can learn from an airline that started with a simple purpose that's grown into a cult-like dedication to what matters most.
Well, at first, the board wanted to upgrade and change the way they did things. They even voted to put some of these things in place, but Herb Kelleher overruled them. He knew that Southwest couldn't do the things they did. They couldn't give people the freedom to fly in the same way if they made these changes. He also knew the airline industry really well and knew that first-class service with bargain basement prices wouldn't work.
When we started out, we said, we're going to have a special niche in the industry. And if we're going to make it a really distinctive niche, we have to do things innovatively. And so we did.
Now, I know what you're thinking. That's a really big company that does something completely different from what I do. And they've got a really big budget to boot. Here's a hint. Even if you don't have a $500 million marketing budget, some of the things that companies like Southwest Airlines do to rise to the top are both free and priceless. Join me in March as I start out on my Build Your Brand journey by exploring Southwest Airlines' origin story and uncovering the one simple idea that changed everything and allowed you to be, as Southwest puts it,
you are now free to move about the country.
Our first new show from Gable Media, Build Your Brand podcast, is coming this March. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 311, How Small Firm Architects Will Lead the Profession to Thrive. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, ARCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more, all free at ARCAT.com. FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. And Gusto, easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for modern small businesses just like ours. Gregory Burke, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. I'm glad to be here with you.
It's great to have you here. You're a longtime friend, personally and to the community, and so it's great to have you here. Let me introduce you to the people who don't know who you are. Greg Burke is a principal architect and president at Gregory John Burke Architect, PA, located in Vero Beach, wrong coast. You're in Florida. His firm and the large prestigious firms he formerly worked with have served clients from small families to Fortune 500 companies. Projects where he served as designer or project manager total more than 10 million square feet and at an adjusted value of just over $2 billion. So a little bit of work. He's a graduate of The Ohio State. And I see that's how the football players say it. So I'm going to say The Ohio State University's Knowlton. Is it Knowlton? Is that pronounced?
Yes, Knowlton.
Knowlton School of Architecture. And he was elevated to the College of Fellows in 2018 at the AIA National for his leadership in advocacy, diversity, and mentorship. So Greg is a great mentor. He's a great leader. He's a contributor over at our Entree Architect Facebook group every day. He's helping people over there. And so it's clearly part of your passion, Greg, to be part of this profession. You love this profession. You want this profession to grow and become a better profession. Long before I knew who you were on my radar screen because you were out there, you know, advocating and contributing to the profession. So first of all, before we start, thank you. Thank you for that, for your contribution and your commitment to the profession.
Thanks.
Let's start off with your origin story. Go back as far as you want to go back. Tell us when you discover architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and give us that story to where you are today.
Sure. Kind of the brief side. I was born with a birth defect, with two fingers missing from each hand and two toes from each foot. My mother got me to hold a pencil when I was 3 years old, and we started with dot to dots. And back, you know, with us old guys, that's how we used to draw. So I learned how to draw and count at the age of three, and really didn't do much. I did a lot of drawing as a kid and always loved it. And then when I got into high school, I was a football player. And my sophomore year, I needed a course that was going to be somewhat easy. So the guidance counselor said, take mechanical drawing. You'll love it. You get to draw. There's no homework and you get the color. And I said, oh, right up my alley. So I got really interested in that. And the funny thing was the first person that was teaching that class was an 86-year-old Catholic nun. So it was really a strange way to start off. I had never really heard much about architecture in the family that I grew up, even though my father had two clients. He was an insurance agent who were architects, but I really didn't know much about it. But from that drawing point on, I learned how to draw and do the things that I needed to do to start my way into it. And then I got a two-year degree in architectural and structural drafting technology near my hometown, Northeast Ohio. Went to Ohio State. I'm not one of those who says the. I don't think I'm unless I'm responding to somebody else. I went to Ohio State. I started working in offices at 18, and got to design my first building at 18. And strangely enough, it's still standing. So that was kind of the impetus. And from then on, after graduating from Ohio State, I went to work for Gensler in Houston, and that's where some of the big stuff started working. And I've worked in almost every state east of the Mississippi, or done projects in every state. I haven't lived in every one, but that's been pretty much the start of my career.
And what are you doing now?
Well, right now we've got I'm operating right at the moment as a sole practitioner. We've gone anywhere from one to five people at any one point in time. Before the economy collapsed, we had five people and we were billing about $750,000. So for a five-person firm, that's pretty good. We're doing all different types of projects. We had a $100 million master plan with nine buildings on the boards. We're doing a renovation of a historic resort hotel on the ocean here in Vero Beach, renovating some of the rooms. So we do a little bit of everything. Vero Beach is kind of a unique place. They kind of pigeonhole architects here. You're either a commercial architect or you're a residential. You don't do both, but I do. The commercial side, there isn't a tremendous amount, although it's starting to change. We are starting to see more commercial work here. Most of my work has been dealing with the surrounding counties. And I do a lot of collaboration with other architects in the area. We get some of the residential guys get commercial work that they really can't do or don't want to do, and they ask me in to support them on it. So they do the design, and I generally go from DD through CDs with them, which can be kind of fun. We did a couple of projects that way in the Bahamas. I worked on a 20,000 square foot house down in South Florida, and we're getting ready to start one with a very talented designer who does primarily residential work, but we're going to do a little art gallery with a art school. So it's a real mix of types of projects. We try to be selective in what we pick to do, and pick projects that are going to have, you know, a little meat on the bones, so to speak.
Yeah. Yep. You're like I said in the introduction, you are passionate about the profession. You have a clear ideas and opinions about the way the profession is currently run, the history of the profession, where we're going. Whenever that conversation pops up in the Facebook group, you're always on that list, you know, talking. And very often you and I have a very similar point of view. That I've said in the past that it's not the AIA's responsibility to fix some of the problems that we have. It's our individual responsibilities. And if we don't shift our mindset to that where every architect is responsible for succeeding themselves, first of all, to becoming a successful architect financially and from a design point of view, that will contribute to the profession at large. But also, if we sort of leave it to the profession to tell our story and to fix some of the problems that we have, we're going to be waiting a long time. And so I wanted to have that conversation with you, Greg, about the value of an architect, quote unquote. That's a topic that comes up all the time. And what is the responsibility of the larger organizations, the AIA and the chapters of the organizations, and what is the responsibility of the individual architect?
Yeah, it's tough for the AIA at a national level. I think we're the strongest support and helping us to move forward as a profession comes from your local and state organizations. We change officers every year.
Right.
That makes consistency a very tough point. And consistency is something that I think the profession sometimes lacks. You go up and down. A lot of that has to do with the way we sell ourselves and what you brought up about value. An architect has got to be able to explain to a client, whether it's in their proposals. And I'd always recommend you have a couple of conversations with a client before you actually give them a proposal for the work. Get to know them a little bit. Find out what they want. Learn something about if it's a commercial project, learn something about their business, how the business operates, what their goals are. And if you're doing a single family house, then, spend a little bit of time with the clients that you're going to be dealing with. Find out exactly how they live their lives. You may have to ask some personal questions at a time, but, you let them know that you're just doing that so you can get a good understanding of how they live and how the house is supposed to operate. You sell that and you tell them you're not going to get that out of a contractor. A contractor is going to build your house. He's going to build your house. He's going to take a set of plans. We've got a lot of good contractors in the United States that recognize the value of having an architect on board and would not do a project without an architect. And then we have a lot of other ones who don't operate that way. And this is where you really have got to come in and try to make a sale. I mean, I, like every other architect, has probably lost a project or two, especially a residential project, to someone who says, well, you know, the builder will get a draftsman. I said, okay. You know, when you run that gamut and you have a problem, come back and see me. And some do. So I think that, you know, from a value standpoint, you've got to be able to show that you can do things better than anybody else that you're competing with, whether it's another architect or a contractor, whoever you're going up against, is that here are the things that I can bring to the table. This is what makes me different and helps you out in what your final goals are. I'm here to listen to you. Yes, I'm an architect. I'm going to direct you because that's what I'm trained to do. In the end, it's your money. You have got to trust me that I'm going to use your money in the right way. So I think that, you know, you really have to boil it down to the things that you do best. And then this transfers over to, you know, the things that happen at AIA. The fact that you have the leadership change every year, and it's the same thing, well, not necessarily local levels. A lot of local levels are now putting presidents in place for 2 and 3 years. I know AIA Orlando keeps their president in place for 3 years, which now you're starting to get a little bit of consistency and you can get a little more direction moving forward. And let's face it, the profession is going through a lot of change right now. I do expert witness work in addition to the other types of, you know, design work I do, and we're seeing a lot of lawsuits coming out of BIM related projects. If you really don't know how to use BIM, you don't know how to plan for it, I'll guarantee you're going to end up in court. So you've got to be able to understand the tools that you're using, and the tools now are not the same as the tools when I was a kid starting out. And, you know, everybody wants AIA to do it for them, but leadership comes from you. You've got to be the one who steps up. You've got to be the one who takes responsibility. You've got to be the one who can show the way. You can't get anywhere. There's an old Chinese proverb that a man can never arrive at his destination if he doesn't know where he's going. So you've got to have a plan. And, you know, I know that in several of your podcasts, you've talked about planning and whether it's financial planning or how to set up your office or any of those types of things. All of that stuff starts with the individual. And the more that we can do that, and the more that we can put ourselves on a proper path and direction, we'll start to bring the profession back to where it should be. You know, we've been losing ground since the 60s. And which is, I basically started that architect or mechanical drawing course in 1969 or 70. And, you know, I can remember seeing a Progressive Architecture magazine cover with two men in suits on the cover saying, "The Rise of the Construction Manager." And yeah. since those days, we've been working ourselves backwards. You know, it's almost, because of what we let happen, you know, when I worked for Art Gansler, you know, they told me the way he got to be as big as he is that when everybody was asking for a nickel, he was asking for a quarter. And that quarter was the thing that ended up moving him, and it helped establish his value. Now, he did it because he hired very smart people and let them do their jobs. Art always surrounded himself with really intelligent folks. And you really... That kind of thought, you know, we've got a race to the bottom right at the moment. Everybody wants to undercut each other. That's not helping the profession. In fact, that's degrading it. And the leadership falls out when you do that. You know, you're not setting yourself up a leader. You know, everybody has to work. Everybody has to make money to live and all those types of things. But there's a lot of work out there, and you just have to pound the pavement to do it. I think that... you know, just hard work is still required. And, yep, you know, as much as we'd like this to be an 8-hour-a-day profession, that's it. It's really not that. You know, put your 8 hours in the office, but use a couple hours every other day, every 3 days, whatever, to do a little socializing and meet people. that's where leadership's going to come from. People will get to know you, get to know that you have a brain, get to see that you think in a problem-solving way, and they will need that help. That will help strengthen your value, not only as an architect, but as a person who can help the community. So those types of things, you know, starting from a grassroots level and working your way forward by meeting people and getting involved will help help drive the profession and help set our value.
Greg, when the topic of the value of an architect comes up and we're having those conversations out in the community, often we talk about how the AIA is at the national level. They're either doing a new ad campaign, or they're trying to identify what architects do, the value of the architects. And you get two sides. You say, well, they're not doing it enough. There's others that say that they shouldn't be doing that at all. What is your thought on that? When they put themselves in that position of trying to define who we are as architects, and that's a very broad range of people, because we do lots of different things and lots of different responsibilities, and so that's at a national level, this is what we are, is a difficult thing to do. Do you think those advertising campaigns are effective, or do you think they're actually hurting the cause?
Well, to a certain extent, I think they hurt, because it's a lot of it is archy speak. And let's face it, the way we as architects talk to each other is not the way we should be talking to the general public. They don't understand. They're not educated as architects. How could they understand? The I Look Up campaign, although I thought it was very lofty and it looked really sleek and they showed a lot of stuff, I don't think it hit the mark. I think that we may have had an advertising group that kind of did some of the same things we as architects do. They don't spend the time to really understand what the public wants and that how we as architects could provide that for them and show the value. You know, they're slick. You know, most of our things are you know, kind of slick. And I don't know that the general public understands that. The general public thinks that we're a necessary profession. We have been going through in Florida for the last 2 years of deregulating the architectural profession. We're on the block with a whole slew of others, including our interior designers can be licensed in this state. We're one of, I think, four in the country that do it. The interior designers are on the chopping block. We will likely get off of it. We just got done with our legislative day, and it's another place to take leadership. We have a very active advocacy group at AIA Florida, and we have a legislative day usually in January at the absolute latest. It's in February, depending on when the sessions are. And we send a whole slew of architects from every community in the state of Florida. You know, this is no little place, to meet with our legislators and tell them why the legislation they're intending to put in place may be or may not be a good idea. And again, we're very highly respected in the state house, in the state of Florida. When they see the architects coming, we bring them a 24 by 36 inch poster. Every year, we've seen some of the legislators that have been around for a while have gotten a couple of them framed and hung them. They like them so much. But we do this thing, you know, once a year, and that's part of the leadership thing. But I think that we have to be able to, you know, do what we do as a profession, but be able to get across to the people, you know, all the things that are happening technology-wise in the profession, in my mind, are really aimed toward the larger firms. You know, we've got software out now that can give you 1,200 variations on a schematic plan. I don't know who has the time to, even the largest firms, to study 1,200 variations and figure out which one works, or which one is the best out of all of those. The people who are serving the mom and pops, you know, and a lot of us are that, you know, the entree architect community, a lot of us are smaller firms that are not serving the large corporate giants. So we've got to be able to understand that the clients that we're talking to are not going to understand Partee. They're not going to understand a lot of the lingo that we use in our profession, that when we, you know, even some engineers don't understand it. So I think that, you know, if AIA really had the opportunity to sit down and really think about how they wanted to set out an ad campaign, they knocked themselves down a couple of levels. Don't make us look so elitist. That's the one criticism that we get a lot from clients, is that we're elitist. And I think that it's getting better. I think that, and quite honestly, now that diversity is a much bigger deal with AIA and with the professional and with the world in general, I think it's helping. I think the fact that there are more women in the profession has helped. You know, we're going to be doing grassroots here in about 3 weeks in New Orleans for AIA. I'm on a discussion panel to talk about. I'm on there with an architect who is female and is in a wheelchair. I'm on with a blind architect from San Francisco. We're going to be discussing how to make the workplace a better place for people who are different, and then also how that can help design. Because when you start to have all these people involved and you get a mix of sexes and capabilities and races and just the whole gamut, you're going to get better design. And I think you're going to reach people a lot easier than we do now. So the more this goes on, and, you know, I've seen a huge change I don't want to give my age away, but you probably figured that out already. I'm getting.
Or you were taking the drafting course in 1970, so.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you when I was born, so let's leave it at that.
74, probably. I've been doing this for almost 50 years, and I've seen huge changes in the way offices operate. There's a big difference from when I walked in my first door for an interview and the way it works now. And I think that's a good thing. Businesses are more open. And I think that's a leadership type thing, too, is that if you're running an office, you've got to look at the people that you're bringing in. You want to get bright ones. You know, I try to find people that are smarter than me, which generally is not that tough. But I definitely want to get people that, you know, I can lead them. I can show them how to do things, but I want them to become leaders. You know, you don't become a leader just by being a dictator. You become a leader by making other people leaders. So I think all of those things, you know, combined are what we as architects individually have to do that the AIA as a national organization cannot do. Or they might be able to do it, but you know, I think with the changeover year by year, it makes it extremely difficult. Yeah. Now that we have a strategic council, there is some continuity in thought. Things that were done 3 years ago are still being discussed and moved forward. So hopefully that whole idea will continue and we'll become a better organization and a better profession for it.
Yeah, I think the answer lies in the story of the individual architect. You were just talking about the panel, the diversity panel, and
right.
and I advocate all the time about, you know, that you individually, by building a stronger, thriving business and building a strong brand and being able to clearly identify and tell your story about who you are and what you do. When we do that with thousands of architects or tens of thousands of architects, that story starts to resonate with the public. And I think that rather than the AIA trying to define who we are, if we are all individually telling that story creates a mosaic and creates, you know, identifies the overall idea of who we are and what we do. And if the AIA wants to support that, the AIA can help us learn how to do that better, help us learn how to build better businesses, how to tell our story better, how to build better brands, rather than them trying to tell that story.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you're right, absolutely, in that thinking, and that, you know, competition is good, but the competition that is brutal is not good, and that only tears the profession apart, in my opinion. You know, I don't mind having projects handed to me. And in fact, a lot of the work I get is word of mouth. I don't compete for a lot, but what I do compete for, I win my fair share. But when I'm up against other people, I mean, there's certain people I can't compete with because of the way they operate. And I tell clients that right up front. But I'm not tearing them down. I just say they've got a different way of practicing than I do. And you know, you're not picking apples to apples firms in who you're wanting to do this. And in the end, it's going to come down to a fee in a lot of cases, is that they're going to find the lower fee. I mean, I can tell you that I've lost two jobs in the last 3 years that came down to the fact that I was up against a guy who works out of his house. A lot of us in the small firms do that. Technically, where I live, you're not supposed to be doing that according to the local ordinances. We're supposed to be in business facilities, but some people can pull it off, and I've lost those jobs because my fees were twice as high. The amount of overhead is not there, and you know you can't fight that. But then at the same time, I don't talk negatively about those people. You know, when you come into the situation, I think you have to say, well, congratulations. You know, tell the client, I wish you a lot of luck. You know, good luck. You know, if anything changes, give me a call back. And you know, this our profession has not been one that likes to share. It has not been in the past. That's getting better too.
Yeah, that's changing.
And I think that, I mean, Entree Architect is a classic example of that. Putting information out there for everybody to see. I mean, it used to be that you'd get in, you know, architects got in their own little corner and, you know, it was like you're in the third grade taking a test and you got your arms around the paper. Don't let anybody look over your shoulder. That was the way architects were probably up until about the early 80s, but that has changed since then. And, you know, we're starting to share things because I think, again, that will only make the profession stronger. We want everybody to be at a good level. Some are going to be better than others, no matter what. You're going to find designers that are better than others, no matter what. You're going to find production people that are better and people in management, too. So I think it's important that we all try to elevate, elevate the boat, get everybody up on high water.
We will return to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors, RCAT, FreshBooks, and Gusto. If you work with specifications in your firm, you probably have come across outdated manufacturer specs with confusing notes, products that no longer exist, or even maybe even companies that no longer exist. Maybe you even pay for specifications. Stop. Stop right now. There's a better way to find manufacturer specifications for your project documentation. RCAT. RCAT.com. RCAT is the number one most used website for finding building product information and has a free library of over 1,400 up-to-date accurate specifications written by FCSI, CCS, and AIA professionals based on manufacturers' data. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find the right specifications for your project and quickly download them in multiple formats for free. That's right, RCAT is completely free. You don't even need to register. Just go to RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com. RCAT.com and start building better content today. Do you remember when you started your architecture firm? Well, maybe you're in the middle of that right now. Maybe you are in the middle of launching your architecture firm. It's not easy, is it? It takes lots of late nights, early mornings, and maybe even the occasional all-nighter. Well, we are crazy busy, so why not make things a little bit easier? Well, our friends at FreshBooks have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners like us. It's simple, intuitive, and keeps you way more organized than a dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds, and then get them paid two times faster with automated online payments. File expenses even quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. Yep, tax time's coming up. And the best part, FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools that you need when you need them, without ever having to learn the ins and the outs of accounting. Join the 24 million people who've used FreshBooks. Try it for free. Free for 30 days, no catch, no credit card. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. To get started, visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. What do you think of when you hear the words payroll and benefits? Payroll and benefits. Does that make your skin crawl? Does it make your spine tingle? Payroll and benefits are hard. It's okay. It's hard, especially when you're a small business like us. You don't have time to be an expert in things like taxes and regulations, a couple of more words that might make your skin crawl. And old school payroll providers just aren't built for the way that we're working today. Gusto is making payroll, benefits, and HR easy for small businesses. Modern technology does all the heavy lifting, so it's easy to get things right. You no longer have to be a big company to get great technology, great benefits, and great service for your team. To help support the show, the Entree Architect podcast, Gusto is offering our listeners an exclusive deal. Sign up today and you'll get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Just go to entrearchitect.com/gusto to claim your free 3 months of payroll processing. That's entrearchitect.com/gusto for 3 months free. Arcat, FreshBooks, and Gusto. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
What about schools, Greg? What do you think the role of the architectural school, or the responsibility rather than the role, what's the responsibility of our architectural schools? And are they doing their job to help move that boat forward that we're talking about?
Well, you know, I know I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for this, but, you know, I think we have three learned professions in my mind, and I'll put architecture and engineering in the same one, but law and medicine. We're probably the three that have the toughest time in school and the longest time that you have to serve before you can do your job. Law and medicine train their people to be lawyers and doctors. We don't train people in architecture school to be architects. We train them to be to understand architecture with a capital A. And my feeling is that we really need to have a restructuring in the education system. I have approached several educators, one an associate dean, and talked to them about the fact that, you know, if we're going to make this a better profession, we've got to have their support and we've got to help have them start to train architects instead of just getting people to understand architecture with a capital A. Quite honestly, I think that's why a lot of people go elsewhere from the profession. You know, we graduate a lot more than actually come and work into the profession because they're not trained for that. You know, you spend 5 years, 4 or 5 years, depending on where you go to school, maybe 7 or 8. Heavily in design, but that's not the profession. The profession has three tracks. It has design, production, and management. And you know, if you like, I can expound on my little theories about the way the school should be operating.
Yeah, I would love that. Because I think we all come out of architecture school, right? Not everybody, but many of us come out of architecture school with the idea that you get into architecture school because you love art and you love architecture and you want to be a designer, right? Very few of us get into architecture in order to be a part of the management of an architecture firm or even the production end of it. Some of it, you know, some of us love that end of it, but I think so many of us, because we're creative people and we have that artist mentality, that we go in wanting to be designers and we come out being, you know, trained as designers. And so there's 2/3 of the profession that's required to be part of what we do. We have no idea how to do that. And I think that many of the schools, when I've approached the school administrators, they've come back to me and said that, well, that's not our job. That's the job of the internship program. That's the job of the firms themselves to be teaching those things. We're not supposed to be teaching those things. We're teaching architects how to think, right? That's the response I get. And so if that's not working, how would you change that, Greg?
Well, I think that what we really have to do is that, you know, NCARB has now got a program where they're pilot testing and getting people with licenses after 7 or 8 years worth of education. And part of that has got an internship, but it's a small one in my mind. I'm going to be real interesting to see what happens with our insurance rates in the next 10 years. If this really catches on, and that's not to degrade the people coming out of school with those degrees. Right now, I think they're picking some really smart people to be doing that. But I think in the long run, I've been doing this for almost 50 years. I learn something new every day. And I think we're definitely a profession that you've got to be continually learning. So the restructure of the education, I would think that, you know, we probably have to go to 7 or 8 years as a mandatory. And then, start tracks. You know, maybe you take the first 3 years the way we've always done it. You're up doing all-nighters, you know, doing design work, and you get an understanding of design. A lot of schools don't teach history any longer. Architectural history in the undergraduate programs. You got to be in graduate school to do that. I don't understand. If you're teaching architecture with a capital A, how can you not teach architectural history? After those 3 years, I think if you want to be a designer, that you need to present a portfolio to a faculty group and let them decide whether or not they think you've got the capability to do it. Generally, after 3 years of being in design, they're going to know who's got the real potential to be a designer. Not in all cases, but in a lot of them. And then at that point, you know, you give an option of either you have a production training or a management training. I mean, they're extremely valuable in firms. Once you start to get over 10 people, you need all three of those skills to be run by an individual or a couple of individuals. So why not give that training and background? Part of the management can also be marketing. But then you would concentrate for the remainder of your education on those aspects. And, you know, you might even be able to do this in a 6-year program. But I think that if you start to train people to be architects, you're going to see more value, because those guys that are in management now are going to get real estate training. They're going to get financial training. You know, there's a whole slew of us that probably don't know how to put together a pro forma for a project. And, you know, a lot of clients, when you get mom and pop developers coming in, they say, hey, you know, I got this piece of property and I want to build some apartments on it. I think I want to have this many, but they really don't have any idea where they're going with it. If you could prepare a pro forma that demonstrates to them what their cash flow is going to be, how many years it's going to take to start turning a profit on those, and how many units they can actually build, that becomes extremely valuable. And then you help them go to the bank for the financing to do those types of things. So I think, and then from a production standpoint, which was always my strong suit, and probably because I just love to draw, knowing how to really put together a set of drawings, and it's not just the detailing, code compliance, all those types of things that we're expected to learn on the job, is drawing back the profession, because on the job, firms have to make a profit, or you don't stay in business. And if you're having to spend a tremendous amount of time training people, the things that we think they should have gotten at least some kind of a cursory review of in their education, you're not going to make those profits. And I think this is also a direct correlation. If we start to graduate people in those three tracks, I believe our fees go up, because now you're showing expertise. And you can demand that. I mean, there are law firms where, you know, a lawyer only makes $200 an hour, which, you know, we've got a lot of architects who are billing out more at more than $200 an hour. But there are law firms that are charging over $1,000 an hour. I only know of a couple of firms where the principals are, and it's the principals. And let's face it, the principals really aren't doing the work. They do the schmoozing up front. They get the work. They may be the designers, but it's always handed off to someone else. Those are the large firm guys. I don't know many small firms where you've got $1,000 an hour billing rate. So I think those three tracks, if the education system would start looking at more at training architects instead of just teaching architecture, we will do ourselves a whole big favor in doing that.
Yeah, I agree that schools should be training architects to be architects. And I believe that those three tracks are equally important: design, production, and management. But my concern is if schools did shift to a model like that, you have a very large population of the profession who are small firms and sole practitioners who want to remain small firms and practice sole practitioners. And that if they were forced to take one track, they would actually lose the value and the education of the other two tracks.
Well, not necessarily. I think that if, and it might take people a lot smarter than me to figure this out. And maybe that's the problem, the reason why it really hasn't gone that far in going in that direction. The designer could still have electives that would cross those other two paths. You know, the average architectural firm is four people. So yes, I understand exactly what you're saying. And, you know, I've been a small firm practitioner now for 24 years. So half of my career has been right here where I am today. And had I not worked for very large firms, I probably would not have the skills that I have today. I very seriously doubt that I'd have FAIA after my name. The things that I learned in those firms and working for them, and I thought I got a pretty decent education at Ohio State. We were part of the College of Engineering, so we had a very strong emphasis on the engineering side of design. That's changed a bit since I was there, for the good, not for the bad. It's gone for the good. Bob Livesey, who used to run Ohio State, was just a tremendous guy that brought in changes and made the university work. There's some exciting stuff happening out on the West Coast right now. I read an article in, I think it was Arconect, that talked about a new structure that's being set up in a college on the West Coast. And somewhat similar to what we're saying, not quite as emphatic as how we're saying it, but the person that's running that school has been a practitioner. He knows what the profession needs, and he's trying to implement that in his school. If, you know, Deborah Burke running Yale right now, you know, she's got a real nice firm. She's done really nice work over her career. She started out small and, you know, just grew it because of her capabilities. I think, you know, having practitioners that run universities is a good idea. You know, and Yale's been pretty good with that, you know, having Philip Johnson, Caesar Pelli, Robert Stern, all those types of people running that university. I think you get a little broader education than you might in some schools.
Yeah. You know, I think whether it's the AIA or whether it's the schools, it is the requirement. And here I go back to the individual architect. It is the requirement that however we find that information and gain that knowledge of design and production and management, we must. If we need to be successful as architects, we need to have knowledge in all three of those tracks. And if the schools are not going to do it, and many of us are no longer in school, there are many students who are in school now. If you are in school right now, go over to the business school and get some education.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes, get some knowledge and basic fundamentals of business, because it will help you. It will help you succeed as an architect, whether you work for a big firm like Gensler or whether you're going to start your own firm as a sole practitioner. That knowledge will make you more valuable.
Absolutely. I had a really oddity sitting on the AIA Florida board. We go to one university a year to have our one of our quarterly board meetings, and we were at the University of Florida last year. And we sat down and had dinner with quite a group of students, mostly third year. And I sat down with a young lady who told me she wanted to become a building official, but she wanted an architecture degree first. And I was just blown away, because that's something being a bit of a code geek myself, I've never heard that come out of any student, that they wanted to be a building official. And the schools really aren't prepared to teach her that. And then that was her complaint, was that she'd like to know more about the building codes than what was being taught. And I encouraged her. I said, go talk to the dean, you know, tell them what's on your mind. And I said, chances are you probably won't get very far, but don't take that as a stopping point. You've put a thought in his head. Maybe it might take a couple of years or so, but maybe they'll bring it as an important part of their professional practice course. They'll talk more about codes, or they'll find a place to put it, or an emphasis in design that you need to refer. You know, we had to do it at Ohio State. Back in those days, we were still dealing with the UBC. You know, we were always told we had to comply with the UBC, but I'll guarantee you that 95% of us had dead end corridors and egress paths that weren't quite right. But I think that can be effective. If you're a student and you've got a desire of something that you want to do in the profession, talk to the people that run the school, and, you know, explain to them that, you know, I like this, and so do a few other people. We'd like to see more with it. And I think good administrators will take that to heart and start to figure out a way to come to yes on those types of things. I think that's what's really important, is everybody coming to yes and finding a compromise or a solution to a problem. That's what we do as architects. But you've got to ask for it. You've got to be the leader. You've got to be the one who goes out and says, I need this.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Craig, before we wrap things up here, I wanted to ask you the question that I ask everybody here. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, I think there's, and they kind of go hand in hand, what we talked about earlier. I think getting involved in the community that you live is vitally important, and probably smart to meet a couple of bankers and meet a couple of lawyers and, you know, people who are movers and shakers in your community, and just get to know them. You know, you don't have to be hitting them up for work. The work will end up coming. But if you get involved and show that you can bring value to their organization, they're going to turn around and compensate you by referring you, hiring you, or, you know, helping you in some way to grow your firm and to be more competent. And at the same time, you can use them as mentors. You know, if you're talking to a banker and you don't understand certain aspects of how to financially run your business, use them as a mentor. You know, say, you know, I scratched my head over this. What can I do to make it better? And I'm sure that a lot of them would be more than happy to give you a hand on it. So I don't think there's anything more important than connections in this business. It really is all about connections. You can be the most talented architect in the world, but if you don't know people, you're probably going to suffer a little bit in getting work done and getting, you know, well, getting hired first of all, and then getting it completed. But I would say make the connections. That, to me, I think is one of the most important things you can do.
Yeah, I agree. When I spoke with Gene Cohn of Cohn, Peterson, Fox a few months ago, that's how they built KPF.
Yep.
Right? One handshake at a time. Gene Cohn is a master at that.
I listened to that interview. I thought it was phenomenal. Gene comes across. I don't know him personally. I'm sure I'll probably run into him at a fellow's dinner or something in the future, but he is exactly the type of guy that you want in the management and marketing end of your business, because he's personable. I didn't hear him using $35 words.
Yeah.
He talked like a human being, and that's what architects have to learn how to do. If you're going to drag the business in, that's a good way to do it. But yeah, that was a phenomenal interview, Mark.
Thank you. Yeah. And he was a designer that recognized that there was somebody who was better at that. And
right,
that he had other strengths. And so, yes, he has the influence on design, and he's done some design at KPF, but his focus was the business, right? Getting the next job and running the business. And he just let his partners take care of the rest. And it was a very interesting conversation. This man's name is Gregory Burke. I appreciate you for being here, Greg. Your firm's name is Gregory John Burke Architect. The website is burkearchitects.com. So you can go check out everything that Greg's doing. And if you want to reach out to him, click the little connect button and send him an email and say, hey, I heard you on Entree Architect podcast. Also, if you're not a member of the Entree Architect Facebook group, Greg is in there all the time contributing to the conversations over there. It's a private group for architects only, architects and architecture students. And so if you're an architect or an architecture student, you can go to entrearchitect.com/group and you can request membership. And we have a lot of really active conversations in there. Somebody posts a question, we get 30, 40, 50, 100 comments on those questions. And it's a private group, so it's only architects talking to other architects. And so I invite you to come join us. Greg, this was a great conversation. It was a very important conversation. And so I really appreciate your time spending here with me and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. It was a lot of fun. And I think this is an important topic, and I'm glad to be part of it.
This is episode 311. If you'd like to access the show notes or share this episode with a friend, the link is entrearchitect.com/episode311. Please share that link. That helps us grow the podcast. It helps us grow the community. It helps the small firm architects grow the profession and thrive. So entrearchitect.com/episode311. Thank you very much. Enrollment for the Entree Architect Startup Mastermind is closing tonight, February 21st at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. That's midnight tonight, February 21st. If you just recently launched your small firm, or if you're working hard at planning to launch within the next 12 months, then you are a startup architect and we want to help you get started. We want to make it a little bit easier for you. We have something very special to help you get launched and put you on the right track for a successful firm far into the future. The Entree Architect Startup Mastermind is for you. It's not just another peer group. This is our 14th mastermind group here at Entree Architect, but this one is a very special one. Not only will you become a member of a professional peer group, exclusive and dedicated to people like you, startup architects, you will have access to our full membership of experienced entrepreneur architects in our member forum. You can have access to them. You'll have special guests and support that's built just for you. Our goal is to get you launched with success so that you can be the best architect you can be. You can build a strong profession and better serve the world by building a stronger business. So that's our goal. We want to help you. And as a very special bonus to incentivize you to join us and to help you get started, only for Entree Architect Startup Mastermind, we put together a launch kit, the Entree Architect Startup Launch Kit. It's worth more than $1,400 and it's free to the startup members who join this group. So go to entrearchitect.com/startup to learn more. And if you're not a startup architect, which is most of you, well then help us spread the word and share that link with a friend, entrearchitect.com/startup. You startup architects, enroll right now before registration closes tonight at 11:59 p.m. Hope to see you there. Love, learn, share what you know. Thanks for listening and have a fantastic week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives.
Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand Podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.